Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Young, it's Here and Now. Democrats and Republicans are saying that Judge Samuel Alito now has enough votes to be confirmed to the U.S. Supreme Court on Tuesday, just hours before President Bush gives his State of the Union address. Yesterday, Massachusetts Senator John Kerry threatened a filibuster, which gave White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan a chuckle when asked about it at a briefing this morning. But the White House might not be smiling about poll numbers out today. A CBS New York Times poll shows that Americans are dissatisfied with the way the president is handling the economy and the war in Iraq, and they're divided over spying on Americans without court warrants. Well, joining us on the line from Washington is John Harwood, national political editor of The Wall Street Journal, author of the newspaper Washington Wire, a column on Fridays. John, welcome.
Great to be here.
And first to the Alito nomination, Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy said there's some division in our caucus, which would seem to be an understatement today.
Robin, the division in the caucus is really a left-right division, if you will, if one can say there's a right in the Democratic Party. People like Ted Kennedy want to look like they're standing up and in fact, stand up for the interests of certain constituencies on the left, blacks, Hispanics, and others who might have reservations. Some women's groups have reservations about Alito, don't like what he represents on the court. Mm-hmm. You've got John Kerry, who wants to run for president in 2008 again and signal to activists in the party that he's going to be on the barricades. On the other hand, you've got many other Democratic senators, moderates in some states, people like Dianne Feinstein in California, others in some southern states, who might even be willing to vote against Alito, but they're not willing to look like they're hanging out for obstruction, and therefore they're not going to support a filibuster. However, the whole question is becoming moot because it looks as if the Republicans have outright 60 votes in support of him, and so by definition, a filibuster is doomed to failure.
Well, you say moot, but the talk might be worth something. One analyst said an attempt at a filibuster might be confusing now. Why, when there aren't the numbers, but can give John Kerry something to crow about if he runs for president again. And also that CBS New York Times poll shows the highest dissatisfaction rates with Congress in 10 years. So I'm wondering if, you know, legislators might be scrambling to send out messages to constituents ahead of the congressional elections.
Well, they're certainly doing that. This is those numbers. Republicans have been very worried about the ratings for Congress, and Democratic incumbents may have something to fear as well. But, you know, when you're the majority, you inevitably take the brunt of it. So I don't think what the Democrats are doing on Alito is in response to dissatisfaction with Congress, but certainly that dissatisfaction is a major reason why another topic, lobbying reform, is moving front and center.
Right. And just sticking with the polls for a second, President Bush has now switched and is using the phrase terrorist surveillance program to describe the National Security Agency program to spy on Americans without warrants. And it would seem that would be a clever political strategy, given that polls found that people responded more positively to the program when they thought it was attached to terrorism.
That's exactly right. It's all, Robin, a matter of definition here. If you ask voters, as the New York Times did, about these warrantless wiretaps as an issue of potential infringement of civil liberties, they don't like them. If you ask them in the context of listening to conversations by people linked to al-Qaeda, of course, they strongly support it. That's why the administration has been so aggressive in trying to frame what they're doing in that fashion. And the president's got a bigger megaphone than Democrats do, so he's likely to have the upper hand in that argument. What Democrats have going for them is that you do have some splits in the Republican ranks, and we'll see when Arlen Specter in a couple of weeks holds hearings on the Judiciary Committee. Specter seems to think what the administration is doing is not proper, may not be legal, and so that could augment the Democratic message in the weeks to come.
And we want to touch briefly on yesterday's press conference with the president and reporters. He seemed hesitant when asked about the Hamas victory. He also continued to refuse to release documents related to Katrina relief or pictures of him with lobbyist Jack Abramoff. He said, well, they'll just be used in political campaigns. How did he come off in the minute we have? How did he come off at the end of this interesting week?
I think the motif of that press conference, Robin, was a president on the defensive. The president's coming up to a State of the Union speech. We've got a big budget deficit. He's not going to propose a whole lot in the way of new programs, and that leaves a certain vacuum. You know, last year he had Social Security reform to talk about. There was the idea that he was going to reform the tax system as well. Those big ideas are moved off to the side. So when the president went out and faced the public, he got a lot of questions that put him back on his heels, and he was uncomfortable about Hamas, the Abramoff story, as well as the wiretapping, and he was put in a position of having to repeatedly say, what I'm doing is not illegal. So that's always an uncomfortable spot for a president to be in.
And then it's always uncomfortable when there's a camera swinging above your head. Just mentioning a camera, apparently a ceiling camera, fell down and was swinging back and forth and provided a little moment of hilarity there in the press conference.
The president's fairly good off the cuff in those sort of human uncomfortable moments, but we'll see whether this we'll see whether the State of the Union speech will help him next week politically. His past speeches have, as often as not, caused his poll ratings to drop, so there's nothing they can bank on.
John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. John, thank you.
You bet.
And we will continue to follow the fallout from the Hamas victory later in the program. We're going to focus on how Israelis on the left and the right are viewing that upset win. But first, on this Friday, a journey into the past. This month, novelist Vikram Seth was nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award for Two Lives, his memoir of his great aunt and uncle. When Vikram was young, he left India to go to school. He lived with his great aunt Henny and uncle Shanti in England. Years earlier, his uncle had also traveled from India to study. Uncle Shanti moved to Berlin, and while there, he was a boarder with Henny's German-Jewish family, with no clue that they would someday marry. And the two were soon caught up in World War II, which would affect their lives profoundly. Well, recently we spoke with Vikram Seth about the story of his great aunt and uncle, really a detective story on his part. And by the way, the first thing we addressed was his last name. It looks like Seth, but it's actually pronounced Seth.
Yes, that's correct. I answer to both.
Well, I read the first 100 pages of your book, and I thought, well, that's nice. You know, he's living with his Indian uncle, great uncle. You go to school, then you leave and become a famous writer. Sadly, Henny dies. And I'm thinking, well, this is interesting. It's an interesting tale. But then you start interviewing your uncle.
Indeed, it's quite a dark story in many ways. For us, we knew that uncle was this dentist in England, a short Indian with only one arm, though how he practiced was something of a mystery to us. And he had his tall German wife, Henny, but we knew that she'd lost her family in the war. That was sort of what we knew, not much more than that. But as I interviewed Uncle, first of all, his own story of how he was sent off as a young man, not knowing a word of German, to study in one of the best universities in the world in the 1930s.
It's an unlikely marriage when you hear how they first met. He, again, is looking to board in a house in Germany as he studies dentistry. And when Henny first heard that this Indian man had come, she says, don't take that black man to her mother.
Absolutely. I mean, it was very odd. But Henny, like many Germans, and she was German through and through, said, don't take the black man. But this was the unpropitious start of a relationship that was to last, 5.5 decades, and a marriage that was to last for 40.
And yet, at the beginning of the story, they had no clue. He was the boarder.
She was
the beautiful unreachable woman. He was someone he couldn't...
I think so, and unreachable for two reasons. One is it wasn't clear at that stage what she felt for him, but also she was engaged to a young man about town, really, Hans Marnert.
Well, and in our first introduction to him, he sounds a little bit like a... Well, I'm rooting for Shanti at that point, your uncle. But he does become so instrumental in Henny's life because looming over all of this is, of course, that they are in Germany. She is Jewish.
Yes.
She might have said, don't take the black man, because, as you said, she reflects the German thinking. But
Of that time.
But then, of course, that thinking turns on her.
Well, indeed.
And her boyfriend, the fiancé, Hans, he helped Henny leave. She ends up in London, where the only person she knows is
Shanti.
Your Uncle Shanti.
She left 1 month before war broke out. Thank God she got out. Mm-hmm. It was really Hans's father, a very decent old Mr. Marnert, a very dignified man who actually got Henny to get the sponsorship, and she got out. But, of course, she had no idea of what had happened to her mother and her sister The mother was taken to Theresienstadt, and the sister was taken to what had been part of Poland, the camp of Auschwitz-Birkenau, and that's where she died.
So Henny found this out in what year?
She found it out in 46.
And what year were you living with the family?
Well, it must have been 69 years after that. In fact, it was interesting that Auntie Henny was the person who, when she realized that I had to learn a European language to go to university, taught me German and used to sing Schubert Lieder with me and such like. But loving the German language for her was, in a sense, dissociated with any feelings of tenderness for the country that had been her own and that had rejected her and caused her family such unbearable grief.
Did she ever talk to you about her mother being killed, her sister being killed?
She did not. Nor did she, interestingly enough, talk to Shanti, who, of course, knew and loved her family. When I was interviewing Shanti Ankli, I said to him, well, didn't Auntie Henny speak to you about these matters? And he said, no, darling. He always addressed me as darling. No, darling, she never did. I said, but why on earth, Uncle? And he said, I tried once or twice to talk to her. And she just said, Shanti, I don't want to enter the graveyard. Yeah. And part of the reason why she was so highly strung, let's say, and brusque, according to Shanti Uncle, was because she never mourned or wept for her family. And this is how I would have understood the situation had it not been for the fact that later her letters were discovered, which completely contradicted what Uncle had said, because in her letters to her friends, she did mourn, she did weep, she talked about this, but these were to her childhood friends.
This is a trunk full of letters that you found as you were, again, start getting pulled into this interview with your uncle and realizing, I lived in that house
yes.
in England for years. I never knew any of this.
But you see, Uncle's own reaction to Auntie Henny's death had been so extreme. He destroyed all photographs he could find, any letters, any files, any papers. So when I said, well, aren't there any surviving documents? He said, no, darling, all destroyed. And I said, but why, Uncle? And his reaction was, I couldn't bear to be continually reminded of Henny. Mm. I still don't fully understand it, but at least he hadn't been able to get to this crucial trunk. It was in a far recess of the attic, covered with cobwebs and so on. And in it were these letters from Hans, these beautiful photographs of Henny, and also the letters, not just of her friends, but also Henny's own letters. Mm. Because she was so German that she'd made carbon copies of some of her letters to her friends.
What was it like to realize you didn't know them, and especially her?
I was astounded by what the letters indicated, because they showed a person who did not draw a line under, say, this country which had treated her and her family as it had, but helped out after the war at a time when people were freezing and starving in Germany and shelterless. She helped her old circle of friends, Gentile and Jew alike, at least those who had survived the war, with food, with clothing at times, which were not easy even in Britain. Mm.
But again, these are things that you find out decades after.
Yes.
You lived...
I would have loved to tell her what I, you know, how much I admired her and loved her, but of course she was long dead. Mm. And indeed, had she been alive, I don't think she would either have spoken to me about these matters, nor would I have really broached them, I think. Mm. Too painful. No, I don't think she would have let me have access to the letters, because she was a reserved person, and, well, I do have reservations, in fact, about the use of these letters. But she comes out as a person of great grit and nobility as a result of it.
Author Vikram Seth, his new book, Two Lives, has been nominated for a National Book Critics Award. Well, when we come back, we'll talk more about the questions of identity that his great uncle and aunt's story raised for Vikram. And later, when art is an obsession, really, literally, there's more coming up here and now. Young, it's here and now. After the publication of Vikram Seth's A Suitable Boy, his sprawling novel of four families in India, the Washington Post compared him to Tolstoy. Well, he's now turned to memoir. His latest book, Two Lives, tells the story of his great-uncle Shanti, an Indian-born dentist with one arm living in London, with his German-Jewish bride, Henny, who came to England to escape the Nazis. Here's a reading from that book.
Where did Shanti and Henny belong, if not in the world of a family? Or a circle of friends? Which country did they belong to? Not Germany anymore, not India. Nor did they have a refuge in the religions of their birth. Both Hinduism and Judaism are somewhat social religions, in that dogma and belief are less crucial in practice than rites of passage and social relations. But their religion or the comforting society of their co-religionists did not cocoon either Shanti or Henny. Indeed, how could it have, since either cocoon would have excluded the other partner?
Author Vikram Seth, we recently spoke with him about his exploration of his uncle and aunt's story and how it raised so many other issues, how cultures come together, how two people survive devastating history.
In a sense, the two cores of the story, the first core being uncle's interviews and the second core being Auntie Henny's letters, do bring out all these questions. For instance, uncle's arm was shot off at Monte Cassino when he was operating under shellfire. It brings into view the history of the Second World War, the Italian campaign. In the case of Henny, the importance of Germany throughout the 20th century, the diaspora of the Jews as far afield as Shanghai, South Africa, California, of course Israel and Palestine as well. And since they made the second half of their lives in England, social currents and changes in the political and social life of England. Because their lives were so long and embraced such wide geographies from India to Germany to, you know, Italy and England, there is an aspect in which the microcosm of their lives reflects the macrocosm of history.
And yet, who would know all of that was going on behind a picket fence in this calm neighborhood in London?
Actually, there is a part of the book where, in fact, I say that it's not just any picket fence in England. It would be, one could say, behind every door, on every ordinary street, in every hut, in every ordinary village, on this middling planet of a trivial star, such riches are to be found. The strange journeys we undertake on our earthly pilgrimage, the joy and suffering we taste or confer, the chance events that cleave us together or apart, what a complex trace they leave, so personal as to be almost incommunicable, so fugitive as to be almost irrecoverable. Yet, seeing through a glass, however darkly, is to be less blind. That is what has motivated this effort. That is all I have hoped would result. These two people whom I loved and who loved me may not, in differing degrees, have wanted every stroke, sometimes distorted, sometimes over-explicit, of this portrait. But they are dead and past caring, and I want them complexly remembered, in sickness as in health, in weakness as in strength, in secrecy as in openness. Their lives were cardinal points for me and guide me still. I want to mark them true.
You seem to get emotional even now.
Well, it's an odd set of paragraphs. I don't normally write too much in this style. It's only in the last two pages of this book that there has to be a kind of balance between authorial distance and the fact that it is partly a memoir of my life with them.
Yeah.
But I can't help but think of them when I read a passage like that, obviously.
Right. Did your uncle and aunt love each other?
Yes. This is something that was part of the exploration of this book. It is an exploration of love, not just of people, but of family and of country, really. But I had to offer various comments about their marriage, somewhat tentatively, because, as I say, very often only the two people in a relationship can understand it, and often enough, not even they. But as to the question of whether they loved each other, yes, the answer was definitely so. Although it was not a marriage based on confidences, it was a marriage based on great confidence in each other and a trust that was really unbreakable, a sense that they would always be there for each other, and they loved each other's company greatly. So it was not the kind of passionate physical romance from the age of 20 to 80. Nor was it one of those marriages where you come home from the office and you confide everything to your partner, every small thing that's happened. They were reserved people, and yet they had, I would consider it, a really wonderful marriage.
Speaking with Vikram Seth, who has chronicled the story of his great-aunt and uncle in the new book, Two Lives. And I just have to ask you before we let you go, Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam just alerted us to the fact that your book, A Suitable Boy, which has been called the longest single-volume novel in English, is going to be sold, along with other books, by the page on Amazon.com next year. Did you know this?
I'm afraid I didn't.
They're going to sell it by the page. And he said he's always wanted to read it, and maybe this will be the one chance he gets to, you know, maybe page at a time.
But as long as he reads it.
Well, I just thought, you know, while we have you, What page would you recommend of The Suitable Boy?
Oh, I've never been asked such a zany question before, but let me think about it. I think the page that I would recommend, well, one of two. Either just the first page, which begins with the sentence, "You too will marry a boy I choose," said Mrs. Rupa Mehra firmly to her younger daughter. So that sort of sets the scene. The other page is a very small section, an entire chapter in one paragraph, just about 20 lines long. It's chapter 17.27, and it begins with the phrase, "Ash and bones. That was all so-and-so was now," because she was then cremated. But who the character was and so on, that I won't specify, because that would give too much away of the story.
Vikram Seth, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And again, his new memoir is called Two Lives. And next week on Here and Now, Enron collapsed in 2001, so why has it taken so long for Ken Lay to be tried? Also, Iran's nuclear program. What can the international community do? Stay with us. Much more ahead, Here and Now. Funding for Here and Young, it's Here and Now. Fallout from the Palestinian elections continues. In Gaza today, angry members of the ruling Fatah party are in the streets protesting the Hamas win, saying they won't work with the Islamic militant group, even as President Mahmoud Abbas of the Fatah party says he will ask Hamas to form a new government. And in Israel, which is scheduled to hold its own elections in just 2 months, acting Prime Minister Ehud Olmert says he will not negotiate with Hamas. The leader of the conservative Likud party, Benjamin Netanyahu, is blaming the Hamas victory on Israel's withdrawal from Gaza. To understand how the Hamas victory is seen in Israel, we're joined by two people with two viewpoints. First, Aryeh Arnon. He's professor of economics at Ben-Gurion University and a member of the Geneva Initiative, a well-known peace group that supports a two-state solution with the Palestinians. I asked him what the Hamas victory means to him.
The only way that we will be able to have a revival of a two-state solution is if a realistic position will be put on the table, and that inside Hamas, together with the Fatah, of course, people will be found that will support this compromise. I don't see them now. Hence, it is a very, very difficult and pessimistic period.
You know, people on the left here in the U.S. are also struggling with the news. Tikkun magazine, the progressive Jewish publication here in the States, and Rabbi Michael Lerner of Tikkun issued a statement saying that while Tikkun has absolutely no sympathy for what he called the murderous terrorists in Hamas, he also said that Ariel Sharon's government and George Bush's government also have blood on their hands. Do you go that far?
I think that the position of the U.S. and Israel in not pushing back to negotiations is really part of the problem and not part of the solution. I think that the strategy of avoiding renegotiations between Israelis and Palestinians became a major obstacle and contributed to what we have now.
On the other hand, we should point out that Rabbi Lerner also says that maybe it's only people who have moved from the right to the center who can forge peace in the Middle East.
It's possible, and what is strengthening this argument is the fact that in all the polls that we have seen over the last year, we saw that Hamas became stronger than before, but also that more and more people accepted the two-state solution in principle. It is kind of contradictory why Hamas, who is officially against the two-state solution, got so many votes from people who claimed to be more compromising than Hamas himself. Maybe now the president, who represents the pragmatist, and the new Israeli government will be able to negotiate with Hamas taking back seat and watching, and hopefully accepting these negotiations.
But of course,
it's far-fetched, but it's possible.
Of course, Israel has said it will not negotiate with a government that has Hamas, as long as Hamas has not agreed that Israel has a right to exist. You've been involved in peace efforts yourself. Your group, the Geneva Initiative, brings Israelis and Palestinians together to talk about peace. Can you see yourself sitting down with Hamas?
I must say that some 20, 25 years ago, the PLO also rejected the right of Israel to exist. And some of us, including myself, argued for a position that the two-state solution is the right way to go, and that we should pursue it, and hopefully the PLO at the time will accept it. And they accepted it in 1988. It is possible that Hamas will go through a very similar process. This is the optimistic point of view of what is going on. If Hamas will not accept a two-state solution and will continue to be in power on the Palestinian side, I see, a very black future for both Israelis and Palestinians in this region.
Aryeh Arnon, a professor of economics at Ben-Gurion University, a peace activist in Israel as well. Professor Arnon, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
And we're now joined by Yuri Dan. He's a columnist with the Jerusalem Post and a close personal friend of Ariel Sharon, who remains in a coma after a devastating stroke. Thanks for joining us, Yuri.
Shalom from Israel on the way to Jerusalem.
Sharon, we mentioned him. He moved much more to the middle prior to his stroke, leaving his right-wing party, Likud. What do you think he would say today about Hamas's victory? Had he ever spoken about a possible Hamas government?
No, not at all. And he regarded Hamas as a fierce and unrepented enemy of Israel. Nevertheless, he told me just recently, last year, that Hamas should abrogate the covenant calling for the destruction of Israel, should collect all its weapons and explosives and give it to a third side, and then will stop all incitement and terrorist activities. And then he will think how to deal with it. But absolutely he regarded the Hamas as an unrepented enemy of Israel.
Well, Benjamin Netanyahu, who now leads Sharon's former party, Likud, is faulting Ariel Sharon's and his unilateral withdrawal from Gaza for Hamas's victory.
First of all, the withdrawal of the Israelis from the Gaza Strip, the uprooting of settlements, had to signal to the Palestinians, hey, listen, there is a place for both sides' concessions in order to create the solution for both states living side by side. They missed the chance by voting the Hamas, that all the people will vote for an organization which created the industry of the suicide bombers, killing hundreds of innocents and bringing to a war which has not yet terminated. I think that this shows, this indicates exactly what's the meaning of the general spirit of a people willing to destroy the Jewish state.
Do you think that Israel had anything to do with that by, for instance, not removing some of the roadblocks while so many of the Palestinians are out of work and without, in some cases, food?
Well, I think that to put the blame on the victims to this industry of death and terror, I think this is misleading. I think that that's the way to present it in the most unjust and unreal way.
What do you think of Professor Arnon's comment that the PLO once was also against the existence of Israel, it came around, and that Hamas might be able to be moderated as well?
That's the best joke I've heard.
What do you think has happened in Israel because of this vote?
The Israelis just got awakened to the writing on the wall. If some of them are still, or many of them, but not the majority, but, you know, politicians, some journalists and others who still believe in a partner on the Palestinian side, they'll have now to wait for a long time, regretfully, because it was Sharon who understood that if Israel got no partner, let's consolidate the lines of security of the Jewish state for many years to come until there will be a real partner to create the coexistence between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Now, this date of such coexistence is now put aside for a long time because of the arrival of the Hamas entity in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
Yuri Dan is a columnist for the Jerusalem Post. Yuri, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Well, don't lie to Oprah. Author James Frey learned that lesson the hard way. Yesterday, talk show host Oprah Winfrey took Frey to task for lying about key episodes in his memoir, A Million Little Pieces. Oprah had bestowed her highly coveted and highly lucrative Oprah's Book Club stamp on Frey last year, and that sent the book sales through the roof. But the Smoking Gun website revealed this month that several of Frey's claims about a struggle with drug and alcohol addiction were fiction. Oprah initially defended Frey on Larry King Live, saying that the essential truth of Frey's life was what mattered. But yesterday, she apologized to viewers for those remarks.
This has been very embarrassing to me, and I deeply regret leaving the impression that I did from the Larry King show that the truth doesn't matter. Because it does.
Well, joining us now with more is Virginia Heffernan, television critic with the New York Times. And Virginia, some people might be saying, well, it is about time that Oprah said that because her defense of Frey on the Larry King show was so stunning.
Yeah, it was a very dramatic show. In fact, I've been thinking that someone should get a tape of that Larry King Live and a tape of yesterday's episode of the Oprah Winfrey show and make a box set because it was some of the most riveting, interesting television in the past, you know, that I can think of in the past 5 years.
Talk about reality television. Well,
exactly.
Well, tell us why. I love the headline on your story. It said, Frey got taken to the television woodshed.
Well, yesterday, I mean, it really just made you squirm. The author that she'd been so supportive of in the past, up to and including on Larry King Live, she just asked him, you know, straight up, why did you lie? And then she asked him about specifics. Was there this character, Lily? How did that character die? You said she hanged herself. You know, is that true? Did she die that way? Watching Frey sort of equivocate and hem and haw was just, it made you squirm. You couldn't but feel it viscerally watching him. You thought of every time someone had caught you in a minor lie. You know, it just,
yeah.
It was surprising because he had seemed like such a villain, and now I at least found myself identifying with him just because she came on so strong.
Well, actually, let's listen to a little bit more of the back and forth.
Since that time, I've struggled with the idea of it. And
no, the lie of it. That's a lie. Not an idea, James. That's a lie.
In fact, there were times, Virginia Heffernan, during the program where I understand the audience booed and hissed him. But how do you think the show ended up? Was it too tough?
I don't think it was too tough to see, you know, finally some resolution to this story, which has been perplexing and has dragged on, about the question of whether this book is fiction or nonfiction. The Times has really pursued this story because it's not just a kind of, you know, Coliseum case of, you know, how can we get this guy? And it's really a larger question about memoir and whether what its classification should be as fiction or nonfiction, particularly on the bestseller lists. And that sounds like a very technical question, but it has huge implications. We trust memoirs for our accounts of history.
And let's remind ourselves, people from the recovery facility that Frey claimed to have attended and had these stories about had gone to the people at Oprah Winfrey's show and said, we don't think this is true. And the Oprah Winfrey producers had asked the publisher, Random House's Doubleday Division, if it was true, and they'd stood by it. The publisher, Nan Talese of Random House, also appeared on the program, and Oprah was as tough with her.
Yes, she was. And I must say, I was a little bit disappointed in how Ms. Talese acquitted herself. I mean, you'd think that someone, you know, that publishes a lot of important and credible books would have an answer to the question of how these books are vetted for fact. But she sounded, you know, as kind of surprised and confused by the charges that the book was fiction as the rest of us.
In fact, she said they checked the memoir to make sure it didn't libel anyone, but they didn't fact check it, at which point Oprah said, well, that needs to change. Oprah has a lot of power. Do you think it will change?
Absolutely, I do think it will change. I think that this was, you know, as Oprah said, the word is embarrassing, and it was embarrassing to her, but it was embarrassing to the book business, which is like has skated by publishing novels as memoirs for a long time.
Virginia Heffernan, New York Times television critic, she wrote today about author James Frey and his appearance on the Oprah Winfrey program yesterday. And the shame of it is, it's such a terrific book. If he had submitted it as fiction, it might still be number one.
That's exactly right. I know. And I think that it's great novels that might benefit from this.
Virginia, thanks so much.
All right. Thank you.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. It's here and now. The 14th annual Outsider Art Fair began today in New York City. It's become a major event in the art world, with millions of dollars now spent on the works of primitive or self-taught artists. Outside art has long been embraced as a legitimate form, but the self-taught artists are still seen as new and exciting, unaffected and pure. The American Folk Art Museum is a major exhibitor at this year's fair, and the museum itself has a current show called Obsessive Drawing. It features five self-taught artists who also share the horror of the blank page, a painstaking compulsion to draw. We'll be hearing from a few of the artists in a minute, but we'll begin with Brooke Anderson. She's the director and curator of the museum's Contemporary Center. She organized the Obsessive Drawing exhibit. And by the way, we have a gallery as well on our website at here-now.org, so you can follow along. Welcome, Brooke.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, you have these five artists' work in a premier New York museum, yet some have never shown their work before or don't think of it as art. How'd you find them?
Oh, there are some really great tales. Three of the artists are pretty well known to people who study self-taught artists and their work. But two of the artists we are premiering, one artist, Martin Thompson, who works in Wellington, New Zealand, came to our attention when I traveled to New Zealand to lecture about our collection. And just through talking with fellow curators, New Zealanders, was led to the work of Martin Thompson. And so we brought his work here to the United States for the first time.
He was a homeless man.
Oh, yeah, and still is on occasion. When he sells a drawing, he will usually get a room in a boarding house.
How do you define obsessive, though? Do you really mean that as, you know, a pathological problem, or is it just, you know, an excruciating attention to detail?
Well, as an art museum, we were really talking about more this lust for line that each of the artists embody in their art-making techniques. More an obsessive quality to the drawings rather than an obsessive lifestyle or emotional state.
Well, you held a panel discussion with three of the artists in the obsessive drawing display late last year. Charles Benifael is the only one diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. Here he is talking about the rage that's behind his work.
My drawing process is based on confronting demons, basically, and I am aware of this, and it always has been. Because of who I am as a person, I just have particular complexes that have kind of built into me, that I've built, actually, myself. And what's ended up happening is I'll be working on a drawing, and I will be fighting with the past. I will be fighting with the person in myself that I do not like. And these drawings become an articulation of what I do not want any other human being to ever become. And it's only because of what I've seen, and it's because of what I've done. And so, for me, it's a very personal process of alleviating the pain that I pick up from others, the pain that exists in my life, and my family's life. And so, that's kind of the rage that we're talking about. We're talking about a rage that comes from a very young place.
That's outsider artist Charles Benifield talking very powerfully about what it's like to have obsessive compulsive disorder. Brooke Anderson, a theme that your other artists talk about as well, the need to work something out. A Japanese artist talks about drawing circles to engage his hands.
Right. Hiroyuki Doi's work is absolutely compelling. Can you imagine a whole body of work relying on one form only, the circle? Not any other shape, just a circle. And what blows me away about Hiroyuki's drawings is that he's able to create such a range of volume and density by just drawing a circle again and again and again.
It is very difficult for me to say this to you, but I feel something other than myself. I don't know. Some kind of external force or something. Or something up there, or I don't know, something spiritual. Something come from deep, deep part of me. I don't know. So I feel I must draw. I must do this. I must keep doing this. So that's why I keep drawing circles every day.
You know, I find myself, Brooke Anderson, sitting here thinking, gee, that must be awful, as I draw my tulips across my script, which I do every single day. I cover every piece of paper with tulips. So I think a lot of people can identify with that sort of obsessiveness with sketching. But Hiroyuki Doi, who we've been listening to, says he's also working out grief over losing his brother with those circles.
He has mentioned to me before that part of his idea about the circle is to represent every soul that has ever existed and to try and depict them in his drawings. And of course, this is going to be a lifetime endeavor.
Well, in fact, you tell the audience at the panel event to be nice to the artists because this is the first time they've spoken publicly about their work. In fact, Eugene Andelsek, who's one of the artists, he was a railroad employee from West Virginia, is suspicious of those who think his work is art. He didn't come.
Eugene was, I think, a little bit daunted by the New York art world, if you can imagine. And he is in his 80s. He comes from a different class. He comes from a different set of life experiences. He's not in the best of health. He referred to his drawings as placemats when I first started interviewing him last year. And I think the adulation and the kind of attention that he was getting from the audience at the opening of the show really overwhelmed him.
Well, Chris Hipkiss is one of the other artists. He's from Britain and France. Here he's talking about not keeping his paintings around.
I don't like it in the house. I don't have any works on my walls. And when it's in the hands of a collector or in a museum, it's what they want to make of it. I wouldn't agree. I don't agree. I could strongly disagree with certain things that have been said about my work. But at the end of the day, it's not my decision. You know, it's nicer just for people just to really love a piece or hate it. It doesn't really bother me. But it's nice that they make what they want to make out of it.
Again, the drawings that we're talking about are at our website, here-now.org. They're part of the Obsessive Drawing exhibit at the Outsider Art Fair going on now in New York. They do sound kind of calm. You know, when we think of obsessive people, we just think of people, you know, going into a kind of a frenzy. Or, you know, I'm thinking of Van Gogh, you know, cutting off an ear. Or is this all inside them?
I think the frenzy finds its way out in the drawings. You know, all these guys operate in society in the way that you and I do, and they all have lives outside of their drawing, though it's hard to believe that, knowing how productive they are in their art making.
Brooke Anderson is the director and curator of the Contemporary Center at the American Folk Art Museum, where you can see the Obsessive Drawing exhibit. The Outsider Art Fair is going on in New York all weekend. For more about both and to see some of the pictures, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.